Okay, this is Monday, February 23rd, period 3, English 10. Hi, Hank, everybody. Hi, Hank. Get well soon, Hank. Okay. I'm going to put the mic a little bit more in the middle of the room. And everyone, please, speak up when you're speaking, okay? Project. Notice how nicely all those people on the stage were projecting. Of course, they had mics, but, well, here's our mic. So, when, I'm sorry?
We could say like anything and he wouldn't know whether it really happened. We'd be like, look at the pterodactyl.
I see the pterodactyl, don't you?
Henry missed pterodactyl.
Yeah.
That's getting used to wondering what's going on.
Look, Sankovich is dangling from his ankles upside down into a pit of flames. Okay. I believe the last time we were together, we were examining the scene where Macbeth goes back to consult with the Wayard sisters. He sees three apparitions. Without looking at your book, please. What was the first apparition? The armed head, meaning a big head and a helmet. And what did that apparition tell him, Grant? Beware of
Macduff.
Beware Macduff, the Thane of Fife. Okay, what's the second apparition? Bloody child that says?
No
man born of woman shall harm Macbeth. So I said, okay, great. Okay, good. So Macduff, you can live. Oh, no, just to be sure, I'll kill you anyway. And then what's the third apparition?
Crown
child holding a tree, presumably a sapling or a branch or something. A crown child holding a tree, and what does that apparition say?
No one will conquer Macbeth
until Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane. You remember in the movie the castle sitting on that high hill. So that's the hill of Dunsinane. Birnam Wood, this forest a few miles away. So that's like saying till hell freezes over. No one will conquer Macbeth. So he says, sweet bodements, good, right? In other words, good prophecies. But then one other thing he wants to know, will Banquo's children ever reign in Scotland? And they answer with this procession, this show that we see on page 129, the eight kings, and they all look like Banquo. No, they all look like Banquo. That's the bad news. And the last one, notice, and this is on line one, this is page 129, line 134. And yet the eighth appears who bears a glass, which shows me many more. Now, glass means a looking glass. In the mirror, you have to remember that film was made around, I think, 1970, which is in the middle of the psychedelic era. You know, Roman Polanski lived in L.A. Lots of people were getting high on all kinds of illegal substances. So you notice that whole thing had kind of a psychedelic, trippy sort of appearance to it. So he had, like, the camera, remember, kept going into one mirror, and then you see the next king, and he's holding a mirror into the next one with the trippy music. But what Shakespeare had, because what Shakespeare is presenting us here is something that no modern audience would get off the top of their heads, but his audience would know. Why eight kings that look like Banquo? Because who did he write this play for? Right, his new patron, the new king, King James I of England, who was also James VI of Scotland, who was the eighth generation descendant of Banquo. Okay? You see, these were real people.
Were they all good?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Shakespeare probably invented a few of the minor lords, like who knows what their names were. But I mean, this is Scottish history. I mean, it's Scottish ancient history, so some of it is, it's all mixed up with legend. But in that semi-legendary Scottish history, there was a King Duncan, there was a rebel, MacDonald, who there were a Banquo and Macbeth who, you know, who repelled who put down MacDonald's rebellion and repelled the Norwegian invasion and so on and so forth. Now, there are some differences between the actual history and Shakespeare's version. We'll get to that maybe a little bit, maybe in a few minutes, actually. But for now, here's the point that Shakespeare's making in the play. James was was Banquo's eighth generation descendant, his great-great-great-great-grandson. So that eighth king, the one holding the looking glass, symbolically represents James. And of course, Shakespeare could know the past. He could know that there's eight generations between Banquo and James. Can he know the future? Can he know how many generations James's seed would continue? No. So he comes up with this very clever idea, a looking glass in which I see many more. See, this is what every king wants. Everybody wants to be immortal. No one can be immortal, but if you're a king, hello. Brava, brava, wonderful, wonderful job. Weren't they good? You don't feel goofy at all, do you?
No.
Okay. Where are we? I got totally distracted by your goofy outfit here. Yeah. Henry, a pterodactyl just flew into the room. Yes. So if you're a king, you can sort of feel like you're immortal if your dynasty continues on and on and on into the future. So that's the idea of this looking glass showing many, many more descendants of Banquo on the throne. Okay, you following this? So this is Shakespeare kissing up to the king. Okay? This is Shakespeare kissing up to the king, making nice to the new king of England, so that he'll be friendly to Shakespeare's acting company. It's a very, very clever thing to do. Now, interestingly enough, it says, "Who bears and yet the eighth appears, who bears a glass, which shows me many more, and some I see that twofold balls and treble scepters carry." Now, the notes there on the left point out to us that the double balls represent England and Scotland. James was the first person to be king of England and Scotland at the same time. No one had done that before. And here is Shakespeare kind of prophesying that in the future there will be more people who will be the king of England and Scotland together. And in a way, this is an extremely accurate prophecy, because what does he wind up? What do we wind up with? What do we have today? What's the name of that country? The UK, the United Kingdom. The full name of that country is the United Kingdom of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. So it's even more than two. And it says the treble scepter, because that represents England, Scotland, and France, because they also, you know, the kings of England and France were always, the kings of England were always claiming France as theirs. The kings of France were always claiming England as theirs. I mean, do you know this from history? I mean, there's this fighting for centuries over that. Okay. Now, actually, let's talk about Shakespeare's history. Shakespeare. We happen to know what Shakespeare's sort of favorite history book was. I'm looking for, there's an illustration from it here. Can't find it. It's called Holinshed's Chronicles. Or Holinshed, I guess it's pronounced. Holinshed's Chronicles. Holinshed's Chronicles. It had officially had a long title about something like the Chronicles of the Kings of England and Scotland and blah, 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 by Raphael Holinshed. But everyone always refers to it as Holinshed's Chronicles. This was a very popular history book in the time of Shakespeare. And a whole lot of his plays that use history take their history from Holinshed. We know that. We know that Shakespeare had that book and used it as a reference book. And so it's very interesting to look at Shakespeare's plays and then look at the Holinshed next to it, because we still have the Holinshed, and compare and see the places where he differs from Holinshed. They're very revealing. Basically, there are three main reasons. See, Shakespeare was not interested in giving us accurate history. He was not there as a history teacher. He was there as a playwright. He was there to make a good show. I mean, do you suppose that at the time of the French Revolution, you know, there was really a Jean Valjean and there was a, you know, a master of the house? And No. It brings out the spirit of it. It makes for a good show. We don't care whether it's historically accurate or not. So three main reasons, three main ways in which Shakespeare differs from actual history in this play and in other plays. The first is to make, as we just said, to make a better show. To make a better show, to make it more dramatic. I'll give you an example. In one of Shakespeare's history plays, Henry IV, Part 1, there are these two historical characters. One is Prince Henry, also known as Prince Hal, who is he's the prince, and he's kind of like George W. Bush. Any of you seen the film W? But, you know, in his earlier years, you know, he was an alcoholic. It's no big secret. You know, he's admitted himself he was an alcoholic. He was apparently doing lines of coke. He was just a wastrel. No one believed that he would ever follow in the footsteps of his dad. Then at some point he kind of cleaned up and then he becomes president. Now, in the same way, Prince Henry or Prince Hal, it was like that when we see him in the play Henry IV, Part 1, he's just hanging around in taverns, drinking, wenching, hanging out with a very disreputable crowd. Meanwhile, there's this other young man named Henry Hotspur, who is this just total butt-kicking warrior. And eventually, the two of them come head-to-head in this battle, the Battle of Shrewsbury. And Prince Henry kills Henry Hotspur and then rises to the occasion. Everyone, oh, he's really a man. He's really noble. And eventually he becomes the king. He becomes King Henry V in a later play. Now, all those elements are there. Prince Henry is a real person. Henry Hotspur is a real person. The Battle of Shrewsbury really happened. Henry Hotspur was really killed there. There's only one little problem in the real history. When the Battle of Shrewsbury took place, Prince Henry was a baby, and Henry Hotspur was an old man by then. Somebody else killed Henry Hotspur. But Shakespeare just loved the idea, and there's lines there of head to head, horse to horse, hot Henry to hot Henry. You know, it's just too dramatic to pass up. It makes a better show. So that's one way that he differs from history. A second way is to bring out certain themes. Bring out certain themes. What is the theme of this play, of Macbeth, in one word? Ah, interesting. Now, interesting. Look what just happened, Matt. You started to say revenge, and you changed your mind to ambition. Is that a good correction? Yeah. You remember when he's trying to look for a good reason to kill Duncan. And he thinks of all these good reasons not to kill Duncan, right? I'm his subject, I'm his host, I'm his relative, I don't want to fry in hell for all eternity. It's the great chain of being, blah, regicide's a bad sin, blah, blah, blah. Only one reason, vaulting ambition. So that is Shakespeare's theme here. In fact, he had recently, when he wrote this, he had recently written a quite a good play on the theme of revenge you've probably heard of called Hamlet, where Hamlet has to get back at his uncle Claudius for murdering Hamlet's father, Hamlet Sr. So he didn't want to write about revenge. He wanted to write about ambition. Now, this is where it gets... Your little slip there, Matt, is so interesting. It's very revealing. Because if we read Holinshed, we find out that historically, Macbeth had a really good reason to kill Duncan for revenge. Because historically, Duncan was not this nice, sweet, good guy king that we see here. He had actually already killed most of Macbeth's family. Okay? There were no real good guys. These guys were all just basically barbarians. But Shakespeare wanted to write a play about ambition. So he has to change that. And that kind of brings us to the third reason, which is, as we've seen here with this show of the Eight Kings, to kiss up to the monarch who was ever on the throne. During the first part of Shakespeare's career, it was Elizabeth I. So he has to make all of her ancestors look good. Now it's James I, he has to make his ancestors look good. Since James was descended from Banquo, Banquo has to be a good guy. Now in Holinshed, we see, again, Banquo like the others, a bunch of barbarians, just homicide, bloodshed, every man for himself pretty much. But because Shakespeare has to kiss up to James, he has to make James's ancestor, Banquo, a good guy. Since Macbeth, we know from Holinshed, Macbeth killed Banquo, Macbeth has to be a bad guy. Since Macbeth also killed Duncan, Duncan has to be a good guy. Okay, you following that? And there's a lot of instances of that in Shakespeare's plays. For instance, in... Richard III. How many of you have ever heard of Richard III, the hunchback king, the evil hunchback king of England? There's a bunch of people who are ahead of him in line of succession for the throne, and he has them all bumped off, including a couple of sweet little kids who were, princes who were ahead of him in line. There's only one problem with that story, which everyone knows. It didn't quite happen that way. That has to do with the War of the Roses. I'll give you just a little bit more history right now, and then we'll get back into the text. Any of you familiar with this from history, the War of the Roses? The so-called War of the Roses was an on-again, off-again, on-again, off-again struggle between two noble houses, the House of York and the House of Lancaster. Now, the symbol of the House of York was the white rose. The symbol of the House of Lancaster was the red rose. These families were cousins to each other, and they both had claims to the throne. And over a couple of centuries, they kept struggling and, assassinating each other and so forth to control the throne. Shakespeare's first patron, Elizabeth, was descended from the House of Lancaster. Actually, it's a little more complicated. She's descended from the House of Tudor, which eventually unites the two houses. It unites the two houses, brings an end to the War of Roses, and the
There's something, I'll show you pictures of this later, something called the Tudor rose. The Tudor rose, which has red petals and white petals. So that's the symbol of the uniting of those two families to bring an end to that war. By the way, do you all know Miss York? She's on sabbatical this year, but you know, a teacher in our department here. She's directly descended from the House of York, the noble House of York. And there's all kinds of ways that it's still in our lives. Anyone ever, you know, the town of York, Pennsylvania, home of the York Barbell Company? Every year there, they have the White Rose Festival. And a few miles away from York, Pennsylvania, is Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So we still have this, the traces of these things with us. So Elizabeth, Shakespeare's first monarch, is descended, comes from the House of Tudor, which unites the families, but they more directly come out of the House of Lancaster. So all the Lancasters have to be good guys. Lancasters were mostly named Henry. And the Yorks were mostly, they had a bunch of people named Richard. So therefore, Richard III has to be a bad guy. So he's like made twisted, the evil hunchback king. He probably wasn't even really a hunchback. He might have had just a slight club foot or something like that. And all these people that he supposedly murdered, really the evidence historically is very flimsy. We don't know if he really murdered all those people. But Shakespeare just, you know, just keeps giving him whatever's the opposite of the benefit of the doubt. Okay, so do you have a sense of this? The reasons that Shakespeare distorts history. Make a better show, right? Make it more dramatic. Bring out the themes he wants to bring out and flatter whoever's on the throne at the time. Okay, let's go back into the text. Page 129, middle of the page. The apparitions disappear. Macbeth. What? Is this so? And then comes a speech that doesn't make much sense. Why is it there? Go down to the next stage direction. Music! The witches dance! Oh. It's another one of these things that Shakespeare didn't write. We are the witches. It's Macbeth the musical, so we can skip that. Okay, but then at the bottom of the page, enter Lennox. Now we're back on track. One of the thanes comes in. And the top of the next page, Macbeth. Saw you the Wayard sisters? Mr. Lieberman, would you be... Lennox, please, nice and loud. Saw you the Wayard sisters?
No, my lord.
Came they not by you?
No, indeed, my lord.
Interesting. Apparently other people don't see the witches. Banquo did. Macbeth does. But Lennox doesn't. What does this suggest? That they're not really there? Or, of course, what do we mean by really? In his imagination. Imagination comes from the word image. Okay. Mike, imagine the front door of your house. You seeing that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because you can imagine it, but I'm not seeing it. Is it really there? Is that image really there?
Not in my mind.
Or yes, in your mind.
Oh,
but in your mind, not in my mind. Yeah. You can see it because it's something that matters to you. It's something that's part of your experience. It's part of your psyche. Home is a deep part of everybody's psyche. What part of Macbeth's psyche might the witches embody? You know, they're the ones whispering to him, hey, you can be the king. Hey, you just kicked the butts of the Norwegian invaders and the rebels. You should be king. What part of him might that be? The part that's just pure desire. Yeah, you can do it. Go ahead. Maybe they're the id. Maybe they embody the id. Maybe they embody the id. Other people can't see his id. If they're his id, who or what is the superego? Which is who or what in this play it keeps saying, whoa, whoa, slow down there, fella. Banquo. What does he do to Banquo? Kills him. Can you see the deep psychological truth in this, the deep psychological insight? When your superego keeps telling you, no, this is wrong. Don't take the cookies out of the cookie jar. And you really want the cookies, what do you do to your superego? Come on. What do you do to your superego? You make it shut up. You make it shut up. You find a way to kill it. You find a way to squish it. And then everything will be fine. Or will it? Infected be the air whereon they ride, and damned all those that trust them. I did hear the galloping of horse. Who was came by?
Just two or three, my lord, that bringing word mixed up is fled to England.
Fled to England?
Aye, my good lord.
Time thou anticipates my dread exploits. Okay, you follow that? Time thou anticipates my dread exploits. In other words, time got ahead of him, of this some dread exploit, some evil deed he was going to do, which is what? To kill Macduff. Time got ahead of him. Damn, I missed that one. And of course, who is in England that Macduff is going to be fleeing to join? Malcolm, exactly. The flighty purpose ne'er is overtook unless the deed go with it. From this moment, the very firstlings of my heart shall be the firstlings of my hand. Okay, now I'm getting down to business. Now, as soon as I think of a bad thing in my heart, I'm going to do it with my hand. And even now, to crown my thoughts with acts, be it thought and done. The castle of Macduff I will surprise, seize upon Fife, give to the edge of the sword his wife, his babes, and all unfortunate souls that trace him in his line. In other words, if I can't kill him, I can slaughter his family. That'll be a good consolation prize. No boasting like a fool. This deed I'll do before this purpose cool. But no more sights. Where are those gentlemen? Come, bring me where they are. Scene two. Macduff's wife, her son, and Ross. Lady Macduff. Eric, please.
What have you done to make him fly the man?
Oh, yeah. Interesting. You think, okay, Macduff is going to go join Malcolm. But, geez, what about his wife and kids? Someone else. Kristen, would you be Ross, please?
He was a patient, Adam.
He had none. His flight was vanity. So when our actions do not, our fears do make us traitors.
Yeah, it's reminding us that if you leave your king, if you're supposed to be a lord, a thane, and you leave the kingdom to join someone who's in opposition to the king, that makes you a traitor. And if you're a traitor, then there's a death sentence on you automatically.
You know not whether it was his wisdom or his fear.
Wisdom, to leave his wife, to leave his babes, his mansion, and his titles, and the place from whence himself is fly. He loves us now. He wants the natural.
Yeah, wants means he lacks. Yeah, he's a good warrior, but he doesn't have the natural touch, the human touch.
For the poor wren, the most diminutive bird, young ones in their nest against the owl. All is the fear and nothing is the love. All, as little is the wisdom that a flight so runs against all the wisdom.
My dearest cause, I pray you school yourself. For your husband, he is noble, wise, judicious, and best knows the fits of the season. I dare not speak much further. But cruel are the times when we are traitors and do not know ourselves. When we hold rumor from what we fear, yet know not what we fear. But float upon a wild and violent sea. Each way I move, I take my leave of you. Shall not be long, but I'll be here again. Things at the worst will cease, or else climb upward to what they were before. My pretty cousin, blessing upon you.
And there he's talking to her, to Macduff's son. Notice at the top of the page it says Macduff's wife is there with the son.
I am I'm so much a fool. Should I stay longer, it would be my disgrace and your discomfort. I take my leave at once.
Sirrah, your father's dead.
Now, remember, Sirrah is like a diminutive of sir, little sir. This is what you call a servant or a boy. Now, is it true that his father's dead? No, but she's kind of... Louder?
She doesn't care. She just wanted to be like your father's a traitor.
Yeah, there's that, and there's maybe she's kind of almost testing him. It's almost as if, like, if your father were dead, how would you deal with him? Something like that. So, again, please, Eric.
Sirrah, your father's dead. And what will you do now? How will you live?
Matt, would you be cute little McDuff Jr.?
That's very sweet, Mother.
What, with worms and flies?
With what I get. I mean, and so do they.
Poor bird, thou shalt never fear the net nor line. The pitfall nor the wind.
Now, yeah. Can you see what Shakespeare's doing dramatically here? Setting up this cute little kid. He's so sweet. He's like an innocent little bird. He says, okay, even if I don't have a father, I'll live like birds. I'll live on whatever I can get. And she's saying, oh, you're so sweet and innocent. You little bird, you don't even know enough to be afraid of snares and traps.
Yes, he is dead. How wilt thou do for a father?
Nay, how will you do for a husband?
Why, I can buy any 20 at any
moment. Yeah, this is lighthearted. This is sort of a little bit of comic relief, a little bit of repartee. Oh, I can, you know, I can just go to the marketplace and buy 20 new husbands if I need one.
And you'll buy them to sell again.
Thou speakest with all thy wit, and yet with faith and with wit even enough.
Was my father a traitor, Mother?
That he was.
What is a traitor?
By one that swears
and lies. Or swears, in other words, he swears his allegiance to the king, and then he betrays his pledge. Lies.
And be all traitors that do so.
Everyone that does so is a traitor and must be hanged.
By the way, notice since this is a more of a comic scene, a low scene, it's not in verse, it's in prose, like the Porter scene.
And must they all be hanged that swear and lie?
Everyone.
Who must hang them?
Why, the honest
man. The liars and swears are fools, for there are liars and swears enough to beat the honest men and hang up them.
Okay, that's funny. That's the punchline. Hey, come on. Everyone, even this little innocent little kid, knows there's more liars in the world than honest men.
Now God help thee, poor monkey. But how will that do for a father?
If he were dead, you'd weep for him. If he were not, it were a good sign that I should quickly have a new father.
Poor Prattner, how thou talks.
Enter a messenger. Matt, English.
List, fair dame, I'm not to know, but when you say of honor, I'm perfect. I doubt some danger does approach you near. If you will take a homely man's advice, you're not found here. Hence, your little ones, fright you thus, methinks I am too savage. The worst to you will fell cruelty, which is too nigh your person. Heaven preserve you, I dare abide no longer.
Oh, he runs out. Uh-oh. In other words, danger's coming. Get out of here.
Whither should I fly? I have done no harm. But I remember now I am in this earthy world, where to do harm is often liable. To do good sometime accounted dangerous folly.
Interesting. What's that a reflection of from earlier in the play? Fair is foul. Oh, yeah, I'm in this world where everything's backwards. Doing good turns out bad. Doing bad turns out good.
Why then, alas, do I put up that womanly defense to say I have done the harm? What are these faces?
Where is your husband?
I hope in no place so unsanctified, where such as thou mayst find him.
He's a traitor. Son. Matt.
Oh, okay. He has killed your mother.
Yeah, oh, you skipped the line. He's a traitor.
Thou liest, thou shag your villain.
What, you egg? Stabs him, young fry of treachery.
He has killed me, mother. Run away, I pray you.
Why does everyone always laugh at that line?
Because he's supposed to be dead.
He's like dying, he's saying he has killed me.
He has killed me.
Not like an exclamation point, just he has killed me.
Yeah. Well,
that's funny.
He's announcing that he's dying.
Not really.
It's like a statement.
Like,
no, it's like a statement.
Like,
you don't
say, like, I'm dead, dying.
It's
more just like,
oh, I'm dead.
I'm in a car.
You don't say that you're dead, because that's obviously. Like, if you're dead,
it's like, I'm dying.
It's like, he has killed me, then how are you talking? Like, he knows he's dying.
Actually, you know, actually, people do sometimes talk that there's a book I read once, a true book about. It was a national park, or a campground out in California, where they cleared out this bit of the forest to put a campground, and the local scientists told them, don't do this. This is where the grizzly bears forage. You should not impose on their turf. But they said no. And they built this campground and they opened it up, and like the first night or the first week or something, some people are camping, and along comes a grizzly bear. This big book is called Night of the Grizzly. And this grizzly bear pulls this person away in their sleeping bag and just starts chewing on them, and like a cat, like playing with its food. So it's like taking, you know, an hour or a couple of hours to slowly chew this guy to death. It's just awful. And the person is screaming, and the people are hearing him screaming, I'm dead, I'm dead. So this kind of thing apparently, oh, sorry to gross you out there, but apparently this is, you know, I'm trying to show you again, just somehow Shakespeare's ear, even when it sounds funny to us, Shakespeare really just has this deep intuitive sense of how people react to these situations.
If you're saying, I'm dead, you're like screaming, but
yeah,
he killed me.
It's so urgent.
Yeah, I mean,
hi.
Well, maybe. Maybe it's just, oh, I'm dead.
Oh, hi.
Okay. Scene 3, enter Malcolm and Macduff. So, therefore, where does this scene take place? England. We know it's England. Okay. This is a long scene where they basically talk about how crummy things are back in Scotland, and they talk about some things going on in England. This is kind of a boring scene, to tell you the truth, and in fact the scene is usually cut out when the play is performed, even though Shakespeare wrote it. Sometimes even Shakespeare gets boring. So let's skip several pages and go to page 149. That was easy, wasn't it? Because it's, yeah.
What happened?
What happens? Nothing. A couple of guys sitting around talking. Yeah, I just said. Did you hear what I just said? No. They talk about how crummy things are in Scotland, and they talk about certain things going on in the court of England. They talk about how the King of England is supposed to have the royal touch, that he can heal lepers with his divine touch. Which, that by tradition, the kings of England were supposed to have that power, although James himself didn't believe in it. So, you know, really they kind of rattle on. So that part's never performed. You get down to the bottom 149, things start to get interesting again. Enter Ross. So here's now yet another thane who has just fled to England. Do we have a Macduff? I'll be Macduff. We have a Malcolm. Who doesn't have a part? Put them on. Please be Malcolm. And Mike, would you be Ross, please? See who comes here.
My countryman, but yet I know him not.
My ever gentle cousin, welcome hither.
I know him now. Good God, behind the moon that makes us strangers.
Sir, amen.
We're out of time. Okay, please keep reading. We're almost at the end of the play. Try to read through to the end.